Good afternoon. My name is Esau Sinuk, and I am from the island of Shishmaref, Alaska. I'm a former Arctic Youth Ambassador, and I'm an earth protector, salmon lover, and water protector. And I advocate for climate change because Shishmaref, along with 30 other communities, are forced to relocate because of climate disruption. And over 220 communities all over Alaska are feeling the effects of climate change. And we cannot wait 10 years from now, 5 years from now, even 1 year from now, or even tomorrow. We have to work on climate policy and climate change right now, today. And thanks to every single one of you here in attendance, we'll make that happen. We'll reduce climate change and we'll save my island of Shishmaref, because if we do not do something today, then within the next 2 decades, Shishmaref will be underwater and I won't have a home. So thank you for all the work that you do, and have a great rest of the day. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jeff Goldberg. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, and welcome. Thank you. Thank you for the woos. We'll also take subscriptions. And prefer, actually. Thank you all for being here. We are going to spend the next 25 minutes or so resolving the unresolved questions concerning the Civil War, slavery, race, and reconciliation in America. We should be able to finish it in probably 20. We're going to talk about some very serious things here, and we have some very serious people to talk about these subjects. Right next to me is Elizabeth Alexander. She's an acclaimed poet and essayist. Yay. Friend of the Aspen Ideas Festival. Of course, she wrote and recited the inaugural poem at Barack Obama's first inauguration, and she's the director of creativity and free expression at the Ford Foundation. Next to Elizabeth is a well-known figure here in Aspen and around the country, Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans. And finally, we have Annette Gordon-Reed, one of America's most acclaimed historians, professor of American history at Harvard University, and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for her seminal work on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. So what we want to do is, I want to start right with you, Mitch, if we may. You just did something that may or may not represent a kind of break moment in the history of the American South and the way the South relates to its own history. I want you to talk for just a minute or two about the decision you recently made, the action you took, and the reasons that you did this.
In two minutes.
Actually, 1 minute, but if you could, yeah.
Well, first of all, we just did something that was very difficult and very painful. As you know, our beloved city was torn asunder by Katrina, lost a lot of things and a lot of buildings, and for the past 12 years, a lot of folks have come together across racial lines to completely rebuild a great American city, trying to prepare for the future while holding on to our past. And while we began preparing for our 300th anniversary, which is next year, we were thinking about a lot of different things. And in that conversation with first Wynton Marcellus and then with Walter, Wynton said, you ought to think about taking those statues down. And I said, which statues? And he said, the one of Robert E. Lee and the Confederate leaders that sit atop our city. And I told him I would think about it, and so I did. And the short story is that the four particular statutes in question were not statutes that were put up to honor those individual men, which many people argue they should be honored for certain things in their life. It was to send a message that the Confederacy was really the right cause, not the wrong cause. And that even though the South, or at least the Confederates on the wrong side of that, we in the South still held to that theory that that's really what New Orleans was about. And as we began to think about whether New Orleans, that really reflected New Orleans' true history and all of our diversity, we concluded that we thought that we could do better. Now, these statutes were in prominent public spaces, and they were in places of reverence. They weren't in places of remembrance like graveyards. And so we went through a very painful public process, lost a lot of friendships, a lot of hard feelings, but otherwise came to the conclusion that the statutes could come down. They did. I gave a speech that was really directed to the people of the city of New Orleans that has somehow now gone viral across the country, which means that this is an issue that is really at least troubling the people of America, and that has led us here today.
Mitch, do one more thing, and then I want to have Annette comment on that. Can you characterize the best argument you heard against your action?
Yeah, I think I can. I think there were a lot of people who live in the South. And by the way, not everybody in the South was on the side of the South. There were lots of people in the South that were on the side of the United States of America. I thought it was really important to clearly say that actually the Confederacy lost and the United States won. And the cause of the South was not a just cause, and it was the wrong cause. And I thought we were far enough away from it to be able to articulate that without people feeling emotional about it. I was completely wrong about that. There were many people in the South who, for many reasons, feel like, notwithstanding what the cause of the war was, that their grandfathers and great-grandfathers actually fought and lost their lives. And somehow, by us wanting to take these statutes and put them someplace else, we were demeaning the fact that they had given their lives for a cause that they thought was important. And I thought that was a really interesting and terrific thing to hear. That did not override the issue of whether or not we should have those statutes in places of reverence as opposed to places of remembrance. And it certainly didn't address the issue of a historical malfeasance for those protectors of history who only remembered 4 years of our 300 history and forgot the other 296 and all of the contributions that all of us made. And so just in terms of artistic curation, if a city is a museum and you were going to remember all of your history and you wanted to be inclusive rather than exclusive, the city would look a lot different and it would be richer for it, which was essentially the argument against what I thought was their best argument, which was worthy of listening to and hearing.
Annette, could you step all the way back and explain a phenomenon that a lot of people, Northerners like me, I'm extremely Northern. I live in D.C., but I don't even like going to Virginia. No offense, by the way. No, but I don't understand why people in the South, certain people in the South, feel two things. One, that the cause was justified, and the other one is why do some people sort of think that they won? Why wasn't it drilled into people's heads in 1865 or through Reconstruction that this was a bad cause and you should regret what you did?
Because it never really ended. I mean, after the war was over, you had a period of Reconstruction that was very controversial, and then you had the period of redemption when they, you know, the people who had lost came back and took over the legislatures and so forth from the black legislators and people who had taken over, you know, had been a part of Reconstruction. And the United States went into this period of reconciliation. It's a civil war. These were people who were sort of, it's talked about as a war, brother against brother, family against family, but it was really whites in some sense in this terms of reconciliation. The idea was to, you know, bring the country back together. And that's what whites did. And they essentially let the South sort of tell their story. I mean, it's like beating up your little brother and then you feel guilty and then you let him have his way. And that's pretty much what happened. Gone with the Wind, you know, Birth of a Nation, all those kinds of things, the sort of portrayal of a gallant South. So the people who are really into this have a very, very skewed vision of what the South was actually about. It's romanticized. And they don't want to give that up. And certainly if your grandfathers and, you know, people, you know, died during that time period, you want to feel that they died for a reason, a good reason. And it's very hard to say to people, no, it wasn't. So we've never really told the true story, but we're just beginning in the last 40 or 50 years. And that's not a long to tell the true story of the country.
Let me ask you one other thing, and then I'll come to Elizabeth. But one of the critiques of these kind of actions that Mayor Landrieu just took is that you're erasing history. You're an historian. Talk about that in the context of is this making history disappear? Is this changing history in a way that's not fair?
No, it's not making history disappear. We're always going to know about Robert E. Lee. I think the thing that he said is very, very important is where these monuments are. This is a public space that's occupied by African Americans and whites all kinds of people, Asians, people of all different colors, different races, and so forth. And the public sphere should be comfortable for everybody. A lot of these statues in different places were put up not immediately after the war. They were put up during time periods when there was contention in the society, and they were put up to send the message that, you know, we are in control. That was the intent of it. So we're always going to have the histories there. Removing monuments is not erasing history. I mean, we know that the country rebelled against George III, but we don't have George III statues all over the country. When you leave, you have new symbols. Things change, and we change the names of things all the time. But certainly, I think the Confederates, what's happened now is that we've sort of moved from the Confederates to now anybody who had bad racial views, the Jefferson, Washington, anybody like that. But I think the Confederacy poses a special problem. And, you know, we can commemorate that and think about that in museums and other places, but not in places where everybody is trying to be together as a common people.
Elizabeth, let me ask you this. Is changing the culture around the way we talk about this, is this a necessary prerequisite to actual racial reconciliation?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that's very interesting to me is that we're asking who gets to speak in public space. We're saying whose voice is in the room and whose voice is not in the room. What we're talking about here is a simultaneity of telling what American history is, right? Because there are so many voices, you know, why are the lions the victors? Because the lions tell history. As long as the lions tell history, they will be the victors. So I think that what we've seen in art, what we've seen in poets, and what we've seen in African American studies is people who have been saying all along, here are the voices and perspectives that you haven't been hearing from. Where I grew up in Washington, D.C., there is a statue in Lincoln Park that showed Lincoln freeing the last person who was enslaved with the Fugitive Slave Act, right? And this was dedicated, co-dedicated with Ulysses S. Grant and Frederick Douglass. That was 1876. I learned that because in African American studies, we're interested in saying the story hasn't always been one thing. And that if we look back and not just stand in this moment, we can actually see a very textured and rich history. You know, why, if you look at the mouth of Harlem in New York City, and, you know, I want to kind of, in a way, speak for the South, because as Bree Newsom said, you know, the Confederacy may be a Southern issue, but white supremacy is an American issue. Right? I mean, so I think that we're really asking larger questions about American history. And so what you see in New York City is, at the mouth of Harlem, a statue of Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman a few blocks up. That doesn't mean that New York is better or wiser, but what I'm trying to say is this business of saying there are simultaneous stories in public space is what folks have been about and need to keep being about.
Mitch, you have an actual city you can organize, you can architect this thing. How would you want to see, ideally, the story of New Orleans and the South be told street to street?
I'll address that, but I do want to say something. You know, the people in the South are tired of everybody else looking down on us. There's a strong proprietary feeling about that. People in the South are smart. We're people of faith, family, and country. We go to school. And I think some of the pushback is, oh, if we do this and we admit that somehow we were wrong, it's going to feed into the misapprehension that people from around the country have of us. South is a gorgeous place. I am a son of the South, which is why we have a special obligation to speak to this issue, part A. Part B, not everybody in the South was on the side of the Confederacy. As a matter of fact, New Orleans, Louisiana, was in sometimes a Union town, and on this particular circle, which for 160 years was called Tivoli Circle, the Union soldiers stayed. And so this is as much an issue about, are you for the country or against the country, as opposed to racism and white supremacy. That's why it's complicated. What I would say about the thing that we're not talking about is the historical malfeasance of not telling the whole story of who we are. Not just because it's unfair to leave people out, but because of who we are is important, because we came from so many different places. So Americans would hear it as e pluribus unum. New Orleanians would hear it as the melting pot or a gumbo. All of our architecture, all of our food, all of our music, all of our poetry, all of our lyrics, all of our architecture is made up of lots of different countries and generations of people, the Germans, the Irish, the Italians, the French, the Spanish, the Senegambians, the Haitians, all putting into the pot and creating something different and new. All of you know this, because when you come to New Orleans, you go, you know what? I don't know what it is about that place, but it's really cool. It's really soulful. And when Katrina hit, if you're being honest with yourselves, you kind of had your heart in your throat thinking, is it possible that we were going to lose the soul of America by losing this great American city? So from my perspective, that entire story is worth telling. And how do you do that? You do it through architecture. You do it through education. You do it through looking at yourself in the mirror and thinking about going forward. So what I would say to people across the country is think about this from where you are. Each city's different. Each community's different. And you ought to think about curating your spaces, because when you think about it, how do those monuments get up? You know, when they have, they say you can't take them down, Mitch. They never said, well, who put them up and how'd they get up? How easy was it? Well, a very wealthy person went to the mayor, who happened to be a Confederate soldier, and said, I'd like to put this up. And they said, I think that's great. Let's do it. They didn't go through a democratic process. They just put them up. And so when you think about that, one of the things I wanted to do was correct what I thought was a historical error and make straight what, in my opinion, was crooked, and correct history, not erase history. And as you said before, the monuments are down, but nothing about our history has changed. So my suggestion for communities would be to talk to each other, to have this conversation, to listen to each other. The most damning thing I heard from my friends, who I hope are still my friends, was that you got a lot of other stuff to do, kid. You got crime, you got potholes, you got this. And by the way, I don't know anybody who is bothered by those statutes. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. To them, it meant, that's not a big deal. We should get over it, forget about it. Or it could mean, you need to get some new friends. You actually need to go find somebody, because when I talked, and you know this, and Walter, you know this, when we began to talk to our friends about this, as Wenton asked me to do, the stories would break your heart from people like world-class trumpeter Terrence Blanchard, who told the story the night that PGT Beauregard was coming down. He was flying into town. He heard it was coming down. He went and woke up his two daughters and took them out there with his wife, Robin. And he said, you know, I went to school right down the street at John F. Kennedy High School. I had to pass that statute every day. And every day I passed that statute, it made me think that those people were trying to send me a message. And when that horse was lifted off that thing, I felt weight lifted off my shoulder and felt for the first time that I belonged in the city of New Orleans. Now, you know, that's very powerful. And I think it's something that we should listen to and hear from people and then act on it.
Well, let's do that. Elizabeth, can you talk for a minute, and Annette as well? Could you talk for a minute about the experience of an African-American driving down a highway called Robert E. Lee Highway, or looking at a statue of Robert E. Lee in a town square, going to Mitch's point? Because I'm not sure that this is fully understood, certainly across some swaths of the South and also the North.
Well, I think, and this was beautifully discussed earlier, of examples, and you'll see I'm answering your question, what Brian Stevenson is doing with the Equal Justice Initiative with the Memorial Project, saying, driving down those roads, driving down those highways, and seeing that commemoration, and knowing the cost of people's lives, knowing what it meant to perpetuate ideology that some people were less human than others, and to profit from it. What does it mean to say, and what he's doing is saying, people were also lynched in this space, and what he's doing is marking the spaces, getting the stories, bringing the families, putting names on jars, commemorating. This is not a cheerful commemoration, but this is a layering of this is what the history is. And I think that the next stage is, what do artists envision? Not so much for the positive message per se, but for the imaginative possibility. We ask for our artists to see things that we cannot yet see, not just to portray that which has happened. So I think that that is an important part of recognizing that there are a lot of different bodies that we walk around in that make this country. And I think that to what you say about, you know, you lose some people and, of course, you gain some people. You know, my father always taught me that you speak up your most unpopular truth if it's the truth, because someone is listening. Someone needs to hear what you have to say. You may not know in the moment, but someone needs to hear what the truth is. And so I think that for all that is lost, I am certain, I'm an optimist, but I am certain that far more is gained by the example also of a white person saying, look at this extraordinary city that is built by many and inherently built by black people. What a bounty for all of us. That's very important.
Well, I'd like you to address that, but I also have another question for you as an historian, which is, One of the fears in this whole discussion, and it's maybe sometimes it's subconscious or it's not fully spoken, is this idea that none of the founders of the United States could ever pass the test of modernity. In other words, presentism, this idea that Thomas Jefferson, yeah, he wrote some good stuff, but he was a slave owner, and therefore we have to discount his history and his contributions. Can you frame this issue for us? Because I think it's one of the things that is actually that's an irritant to this issue, this worry and backlash on the part of a lot of patriotic white Americans, certainly, that what's going on is a systematic attempt to tell America that all of its founders were bad people.
Well, I would first distinguish between people who wanted to build the United States of America and people who wanted to destroy the United States of America. So to lump the founders in with the Confederates, that's a different conversation, I think. Presentism is an issue. I mean, you can't judge people totally by the standards of their time, but you also think of their time. There were people who were better in some ways. I mean, it was not a common thing, obviously, for people to be racially sensitive in the 18th century. That was not a part of their world. I think it's possible to recognize people's contributions at the same time as recognizing, you know, their flaws. You're not going to have American history without Jefferson. I mean, it's not the Soviet Union, where they erase people when they're out of a picture. You see a picture of Stalin, and if the person is in favor, they're still there, and then they Photoshop them out. We can't do that here. You have to tell the story of what happened. I mean, the Declaration of Independence is real. The University of Virginia is real. The Library of Congress. I mean, just go on and on and on. But you can't tell that story without telling the other part. I think that's the thing to do. And I think what people feel is that by talking about slavery, by talking about Monticello, talking about Sally Hemings, talking about those things, you're suggesting that he cannot be a person who is a part of American history. And I think that's wrong. I think the Confederates are a bit different. Going back to your previous question about how you feel, I always thought, I grew up in Texas, that it was particularly insulting to have people honoring Confederates when to honor a flag that flew against the United States of America. I mean, Jefferson and the founders, that's a different time, it's a different struggle, but this was really, I think, even more so, as you said, sending a message. That was a message for today. So the presentism of those monuments and statues is really about trying to maintain white supremacy, maintaining the idea and being recalcitrant in the face of the loss of the war. So I would distinguish, and this is what happens, one thing gets started and you kind of go down the slippery slope and you pull everybody in. I do think that there's a difference between the way we deal with the founders and the way we deal with the Confederates, the sort of anti-founders, because that's a completely different vibe and different historical situation.
At the risk of stating the obvious, I am white. I am an American.
Are you sure?
And I am...
You're from New Orleans. You know better than that.
I don't talk about all my people. Y'all know. I'm white. I'm an American. I'm from the South, and I'm proud of it. But those Confederate generals never reflected to the world who I was, who I thought my history was, so they did not speak for me as a first example. So not everybody in the South is a Confederate sympathizer. Secondly, not everybody that still supports the ideas of those monuments staying up is a racist. Many of those people, to the argument on their side, was that, look, that's a piece of my history. I grew up there as a little girl or a little boy. It's kind of like when your local stores go away, like from New Orleans, King & Bee and Gotchaws, and all the places where you shop, they're like, oh my goodness, they're taking away my childhood. So that's one part of it. But the other issue is what's not there, that historical malfeasance of not remembering everything or misremembering specific parts of history. So, for example, President Obama and President Bush addressed this in the opening of the African American Museum about the slave block. And they said for many, many years, the only thing we remembered about that slave block was that two very prominent white politicians spoke from that. And we never took that same slave block and remembered the thousands and thousands and thousands of men and women that was sold. Same piece of equipment, same piece of history, two different stories. One was told, one wasn't. So not only do African Americans who I've talked to feel oppressed and left out and getting the message about we're still in charge, but then the absence of anything that even remembered their struggle or celebrated their victories. And by the way, this actually applies to all the Italians, the Spanish, all of the immigrants. All of that stuff is not curated well. And then finally, I'll say this because I actually had to make this decision. When I had to, after talking to the public, think about what monuments, I was aware of the slippery slope argument. Oh my God, he's going to get rid of Jefferson. He's going to get rid of Andrew Jackson, which sits right in the middle of Jackson Square and is the most prominent statue. And I concluded exactly like you did. I separated people who fought for the United States and people who fought against the United States. And the Confederacy was against the United States, and thank God they lost. But it seems to me that you can separate these things in many, many ways. Not only that, Andrew Jackson fought to save the city of New Orleans. He fought for the United States of America. He's got a bad past in some instances, but if you're revering him in the right place and at the right time for the right thing, and this is even true about Robert E. Lee. So, for example, there's a university named after Robert E. Lee. I would not argue that you should change the name of Washington and Lee. The reason is because they named that university for him as something really wonderful he did after he finished that was very positive, that has educated generations of people. And I think we're smart enough and we're mature enough and we now have enough distance to handle this with care so that we're soft on the people and hard on the problem so we can course correct our history, look at ourselves in the mirror, allow everybody to come into this discussion, and in my opinion, long term, we're going to be better for it.
I want to put one more big question in front of the three of you, and I know, Annette, you also want to make an intervention here, but the big question, this is all happening against a certain political backdrop. The people who voted for Donald Trump, some of them voted as a form of cultural backlash, right? The country was changing. They didn't like the way the country was changing. Donald Trump was standing for certain things. We all remember 2009. Some people thought we were heading into a brilliant post-racial future. I want you to contextualize this, each of you, where we are in America. Are we on President Obama always said, quoting Martin Luther King, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. My colleague Ta-Nehisi Coates argues that the moral arc of the universe is short and bends toward chaos. As an optimist and a pessimist there, frame the answer that you're going to give to that question in the context of this fight over culture and memory in the South. You each take it if you want.
I think that many things are true at once. America is a very, very complicated country. And I think that in order to understand it, we really do have to understand simultaneous strands so that while we have a moment now where xenophobia as an ideology has been raised up, othering of people has been raised up, vile language against other people has been sadly raised up, I really do think, and this isn't actually just the optimist speaking, this is a very pragmatic historical look at this moment. There is so much else that has come to power, and I'll stay in the cultural sphere just because I think it's a vibrant one and it's sort of where I stand, and that we don't yet know what the continual oppositional and forward-looking impact of that will be. So.
Well, I would say I don't know, because it's hard to think of the United States outside of the context of the world. And things are happening in the world that will have an influence on this. Brexit, the rise of nationalism in other parts of Europe, the problem with immigration and refugees and so forth. We're in a weird moment. I'm neither optimistic or pessimistic about it. I mean, we just have to see.
Is this the feeling this of backlash? Is this the last gasp of forces that also venerate the Confederacy? Or
I'm a historian. I'm supposed to write about the past. I don't predict the future.
Make believe we're in the future and then just look back.
And that the person who's historian hat off. I don't know. I don't think we know the answer to that. Is it we could be in for there was a such thing called the Dark Ages. And the dark ages, people tell us now, we're not as dark as we thought, but there could be, we're in a moment of retrenchment, and we don't really know, I don't think we can say with certainty whether this is the dawn of a new day, the last gasp, or something that's changed, because it's been so startling. There's nothing that I could ever have envisioned, and we don't know.
By the way, that's a classic Aspen Ideas panel, the dark ages. How dark were they?
They were so dark.
No, we'll do that next hour.
And don't you think also, I think that since we both said I don't know, I think that, but what will we listen to? You know, Tracy K. Smith, the luminous poet, has just been named our poet laureate. She has nothing to do with this darkness. Look for her work, Tracy K. Smith. I think it's not sort of being blind to say there is a lot of righteous power out there.
Yeah.
Listen to it and be empowered.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the hope that you can, if you want to fight against the idea that this is a backlash and it's something that's going to go on, there are signs of hope. Look at what's happened, with gay rights, for example. How quickly you had a social change on that question, an amazingly short amount of time. Things in the midst of all of this, in a retrenchment in other ways. So we really don't know.
Right.
It's an open question.
Mitch, final quick question for you. It's the same theme. You are a rare bird. You're a white male Democratic politician in the South. I'm not going to be over optimistic about the current political situation in this context. You've had a hell of a time the last few months in the South making your arguments. Where are we on the arc of resentment and backlash?
Well, I think this is what I would say. I think that human beings have tremendous capacity for evil. We've seen that over our history. And we also have a tremendous capacity for good. And we've seen that over history. And history undulates. And the question is where we are now. I do think to try to get in the middle of Ta-Nehisi and Barack, I do think the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. I do think that, because I think that goodness always outweighs evil. But it's got to show up. In other words, somebody's got to bend it. And if you don't show up, and if you don't talk, and if you don't listen, then there's a chance that the dark forces will win. But I want to speak to this issue, because everybody keeps wondering about Trump. He's just a symptom. He's not the cause. You have poor working class white people living in Appalachia. You have poor people in Ohio. The opioid addiction is strangling to death people. They're not working. And then you have the African American community saying, well, listen, we've never really reconciled. And then you have a whole bunch of other people in angst. The question is, why are they in angst? That's the big question. And so generally, everybody knows this already. You know this. If people are hungry, if they're wet, if they're afraid, if they feel like somebody's taking something away from them and it's a zero-sum game, it's easy to turn them against each other. And that's the common thread that you see on immigration. It's the common thread that you see on the refugees. It's the common thread you just see. And right now, people have not been able to find that common ground. And our job is to discipline ourselves as adults into a better and thoughtful conversation and demand that not only our elected officials, because they're kind of following y'all. I don't know if anybody knows this, but politicians like to get reelected mostly. They're kind of following the lead of the people. It's everybody's job to kind of recognize that we're in a very dangerous moment. And if we don't want to stay here, there is a better pathway and there is a better place. And if we all work hard to get there, I really feel very comfortable that we will.
Thank you very much to the three of you. Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
I too sing America. I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America. Thank you. So my name is Nkosi Nkululeko. I'm about to go into this piece about Paul Robeson. And if some of you know his work, you may have seen a movie, Emperor Jones, which is a fantastic movie that I loved and grew up watching. And there was a scene near the end where he's in the forest, haunted, spirits and such. And I have a piece of my own that I would like to share. I'm from Harlem, and I'm a poet. I'm affiliated with the Creative Young Leaders Alliance. And thank you very much for listening. And while I do this piece, I'll thankfully be collaborating with an amazing artist, Lil Buck. Thank you. The Emperor of Kings for Paul Robeson. I want to be a king as bad as a king wishes to be the son of a king. An endless line of inheritance and heritage. Cyclical wealth recurring to me like a wheel. I used to be a nigger, now I'm a Negro. I used to be a Negro, now I'm not. I used to kneel in front of white men, my back growing open like canals, strips of marigold and rose colors lining my spine like a garden. I used to know. I used to know kings born under the misty sky of the east, velvet capes warming skin as white as the snow that fell slow on the soft earth. I used to want that. Gold-plated mirrors, my face shining through the glass like a stream of light hailing through the clouds at noon. Never have I ever conquered a thing. That's unusual power for the darker brother. But here I progress. Here I'm used to power. Let me Napoleon, let me Caesar, let me Hannibal, or let me Turner. Sometimes I wonder if my wants exceed me. My little desires swelling inside my chest like air. But who am I not to want? I give in to my nature to have. I used to be a nigga, but now I'm a king. No, I'd rather be named emperor, ruler of a nameless country. Beware the men who willingly rule. Beware the men who serve willingly. I wish I could will more. I look in the mirror and see a country revived from their shambles. And that's power, the glint the eye reveals in the shade of midnight. I cradle a crown like a child, dark and small as an emblem of worship, my mind frizzled with the idea that kings are made from the fools who serve them. My mind has left and another has come. I've come to believe that a king is not a king until his people has suffered. Like any system, my people are pained by it, shriveled in the brittle ground with nothing but debt to follow their children. I almost had a son until I decided wealth is better left with the dead. Even foolish people know kings and emperors alike betrayed for power. Yet we follow as if addicted to powerlessness. But beware the powerless. Beware the tribes of cowards. Even the weak will one day abandon their emperor in the dark spaces of their own kingdom. The emperor possessed by shame. Doesn't it sadden you to know the ones you worship belong to the ones you don't? Doesn't it sadden you that kings can abandon too? I'm at war with my own, and I want to be a king as bad as a king wants to be a king when alone. driven mad by the sound a drum makes in the forest when a war draws near. I used to be a nigger, then a Negro. I used to be a Negro, now I am not. I used to be an emperor of a country without a name, and now an emperor. I am not. Thank you. Thank you.
Give them another round of applause so we don't walk on awkwardly. Real quickly, too, do you all want a seventh inning stretch really quick because you've been sitting for a long time? Do you just want to stand up quickly, stretch? My in-laws, Herbie and Paula, I hope they're still here. Stand up and stretch. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Good. Okay, that's it. No more stretching. Hi, everyone. Welcome. I'm Katie Couric. We have a great panel to talk about really restoring trust in the Fourth Amendment, and I'm really honored to be joined by this illustrious group. Let me introduce everyone. We have Jerry Baker, Editor-in-Chief of the Wall Street Journal, and Joanne Lippman, who is Chief Content Officer of Gannett, Editor-in-Chief of USA Today. We have Nick Diogan, Editor-in-Chief of CNBC, Nancy Gibbs, the Editor-in-Chief of Time Magazine, and Jeff Goldberg, Editor-in-Chief of The Atlantic. We have too many chiefs on this stage, don't you think? But welcome, everyone. Nice to see you. Okay. So we have 40 minutes to talk about a lot of things, so let's get right to it. This is a good day to have this conversation. The cover of the New York Post this morning, CNN, most busted name in news following the story where three reporters were forced to resign. The media is still buzzing about a confrontation between a White House reporter and Sarah Huckabee Sanders about fake news. Sarah Palin is suing the New York Times. And the president tweeted three times just this morning accusing the New York Times and the Washington Post and implicitly threatening Amazon and considering those newspapers as being fake news. And Nancy, you're trying to get the fake Time magazine covers emblazoned with President Trump's face taken off the walls of several Trump golf clubs. What a world. So, real quickly, since this title is about restoring trust and less than 40% of the country says that the media can be trusted most of the time, I'd like to go down the line and ask each of you to briefly explain how we got to this place. Jerry, I'll start with you.
Thank you, Katie, and it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. I should start off by saying that was a very helpful litany of the current woes that confront the media, and I should say straight away that I'm an optimist, by which I mean I see the glass currently as one-tenth full rather than nine-tenths empty. Look, I think, and we'll have an interesting discussion, I'm sure. I do think that the media, first of all, we like to talk about nothing else more than the media, which probably is a reflection of our own insecurities and psychological problems that we have ourselves. But I do think clearly there has been, as you cite that poll, there has been a diminution of trust in the so-called mainstream media. Not a phrase I like, but it resonates. People know what it means. And I think it's important to see that in a very long-term historical context. It would be wrong just to think that fake news has come up in the last couple of years, or Donald Trump, or for that matter, Breitbart or Fox News or any of these organizations that probably you hear all are not terribly big fans of. It would be wrong, I think, to just suggest or believe that those are the problems. The problems go back much deeper, and I think there has been, unfortunately, a steady decline in trust in the media because a very large part of this country has not felt served by the main news media for a very long period of time. They've felt that they deal with those issues that are interest to the media and to the people, the media elites on both coasts, and they don't deal with the issues that confront most Americans. And I think it's that has driven the decline in trust over a long period of time.
We're going to get to more about that in a few minutes on this panel, but Joanne, quickly, what do you think?
Jared's last point. So at Gannett, so we own USA Today and 109 local newspapers, local news organizations like the Detroit Free Press and the Cincinnati Enquirer, the Des Moines Register. And to your point, what we see is at the local level, you do still see trust in the media. And that's because you've got local reporters who are ingrained in their community. There's a lot of forgotten voices, and particularly with the national media, which as the media has been under pressure, has really retreated to the coasts. And you've got the entire middle of the country, many people feel underserved. And so from where I sit, where we have both the national publication and the locals, you can see that at the local level, where there's local reporters whose kids are going to school with your kids, where your concerns and worries and thoughts are reflected in your local media, it makes all the difference.
Nick?
I'll be somewhat brief since I'm watching the clock for you, Katie.
Thank you, Nick.
As the TV guy over here.
Thank you.
But I would pick up a little bit on what Joanne said in that, and what Jerry said in that. I don't think the media is as monolithic as people make it out to be. We're lucky and blessed at CNBC in that all our research has shown is that our credibility has never been higher, our brand position has never been stronger. And the reason for that is we stick to what we do. We cover business and we cover facts and data, and that's what we deal with day in and day out. And on the back of that, we've had strong results, and our digital platform is growing tremendously. At night, we're essentially more of we do more entertainment program focused on entrepreneurship, but that resonates with an audience. So I think it's a bit of a mistake to say the media at large and people have lost trust in it. There's also a proliferation of media. And so some of it is, this is the, as a capitalist and a free marketer, that this is also the marketplace working, where lots of people have different opinions over different types of media.
Nancy?
All I would add is this is part, as Jerry suggested, this is part of a at least 50-year, go back to, you know, 1967, 68, at least a 50-year diminution of trust in institutions, not just in media. You see it in the organized church, and certainly in elected politicians, in business, in leadership, almost across the board. And with that, the enormous transfer of influence from institutions to individuals. And so now that everybody, we are living in a time where everybody can be a publisher, can be a citizen journalist, can express their views and do their investigations and be part of a conversation in a way that was never possible before. It is keeping everyone honest in a way, challenging us if we get something wrong, pushing us in outside of comfort zones. Much of that is a very good and healthy thing. You know, none of us likes to be the objects of the kind of antipathy and active hostility that we encounter now. But I also think some of it reflects the fact that there is no monopoly on authority and information anymore, and there is a virtue to that that should keep us humble and respectful and responsible in the way we go about our business.
Jeff?
Well, everything that was needed to have been said was said, but not by me, so I'm just going to repeat it. Let me make a very, very quick point, which is I'm going to sound very optimistic, I think. And our experience at the Atlantic over the past months has been that, and we're a 160-year-old organization, we've never had more readers than we have right now in digital, tens and tens of millions of readers. And think about this, in subscriptions, print subscriptions, we've never had more print subscribers. Think about how deep we are into the digital age. We've made a bet, and it's based on the idea that the scarcest commodity in journalism right now is quality, and that there are millions and millions of people in America and across the world who want quality journalism. I think we're being rewarded for that bet. And so I take that as a sign of the health of democracy and the health of quality journalism.
And a shameless plug for the
Atlantic. Wow, that was particularly shameless, by the way.
Jerry, fake news is often used as a mantra by the president to describe stories he believes are not true or stories he simply doesn't like. How effective has this mantra been, not so unlike Lion Ted or Crooked Hillary, in discrediting the mainstream media and planting seeds of doubt in the minds of Americans everywhere?
I mean, I don't think he has created a mistrust of the media, for all we just said, without just
recapitulating. Don't you think he's exacerbated it?
He's certainly done a very effective job of reminding people what they don't like about the media. Look, I do think we have this phenomenon now, and Nick touched on this a little bit. You do have a plethora of media. You do have different views represented. You do have the situation, though, where people choose their own news, in effect. They choose their own facts. There was a Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the great New York senator, used to have a great line, which he said, you know, you're in an argument, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. These days, people basically are entitled, don't think they're entitled to their own facts, so they choose their own facts. So what Donald Trump does very well is to play on the reservations that people, putting it mildly, reservations that people already have about, be it the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, or whatever, and actually it becomes a partisan, it becomes an even more partisan issue. So he does a very good job of actually diverting attention from the facts, if you like, just to say to people, look, if it appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or CNN, you don't have to believe it because it's not true. And I think many, many people are actually willing to go along with that.
And Nancy, in fact, Time Magazine did a very provocative cover recently asking, is truth dead? And what motivated that cover? And you have sort of an interesting backstory, if you will, about putting it together.
We actually reached out to the White House to talk to the president about this question, about the accusation that his treatment and vision of the truth was unlike any that we had seen in a president ever before, and that this had become such a central topic of conversation. What does it do to the national conversation when we are not able to agree even on the facts of the size of an inaugural crowd? And he agreed to talk to us for that story, and some weeks after that cover appeared, the reporter who wrote it and I had dinner with the president at the White House and talked about that story, which he liked. But no, the important thing is he liked that story because he felt that it gave him a chance to make his case, that in fact, you know, when he talked about these terrible violence in Sweden, that had turned out actually to be true because the day after he tweeted that, there was actually a big demonstration.
But that was after the fact.
He points to any number of occasions when nobody believed him, including that he could actually win the White House, and that he absolutely believes that there are things that he knows and sees that other people don't know and see.
And did he discuss all those illegal voters on election day that kept him from winning the popular vote?
No, but we talked about the size of the inaugural crowds. And I think that question of all of the issues around, you know, true and false, the inauguration sort of became the iconic one. And literally standing in front of a photograph of the inauguration as he pointed out where the crowds had been held back by the Park Service barriers and where they were actually bigger. I am misreading something, but I would swear that he genuinely believes that his inaugural crowd was bigger, that he is not lying. The reason we all have debated about the use of that term.
And we're going to talk, yeah.
He wants credit for something he thinks he's not getting credit for. And I think it is important with any president to be mindful of the way they are perceiving something and what they believe. That's an important part of making a judgment about their administrations, their policies. And so in this case, I come away absolutely believing that he continues to come back to the size of the inaugural crowds because he believes that his were in fact bigger.
And we're going to talk about sort of the use of the word lie in journalism in a moment. But Jeff, when the president constantly tweets that different newspapers are examples of fake news, like the Washington Post or the New York Times, and accuses reporters of being fake news at White House briefings or when he appears before reporters there, what's your reaction?
Well, part of my reaction is that we're all engaged in a reality TV show, that this is a reality TV version of a war between a president and the press. And I mean that in one specific sense. Right now, we're all benefiting. The weird part of this is, of course, when the New York Times and the Washington Post get tweeted at this way, their subscriber base goes up, right? More people subscribe and want to support them. The problem is, and this is what I worry about more than anything else, is that there are people in the country who don't understand that this is a cynical reality TV game, and are going to hear over and over again from the president that the reporters, journalists, are enemies of the state. And someone, I mean, God forbid, but someone is going to do something violent against journalists in a large way. And then I know where the fault lies. And we're heading in this direction, and it's quite frightening.
But in a less dramatic way, what about just the erosion of credibility and believability and people feeling that they can trust in any way, shape, or form, you know, the newspapers they're reading?
Well, I don't think that beyond his base, these tweets have the influence that we're talking about. The problem is that there's two Americas, and one America, which I think is slightly larger than the other America, believes more or less, understands that journalists are flawed, but believes what these newspapers are telling them, what we're all telling them, and then there's another portion that won't believe it. The real problem, besides the problem of prospective violence or prospective anger gone unchecked, the real problem is that in the Trump presidency, nothing really has happened yet. Remember, there's been no Katrina, no Sandy, no San Bernardino, no Orlando. And when you have a crisis, you need two things to be. You need the people of the United States to believe in two things: one, that the president is telling them the truth, and the other is that they're getting accurate information from the media. This is being eroded, and that's another serious problem.
Can I add one more point, though? Because I really feel that when the president talks about the press as the enemy, it's really important, it's on us, the press, to not set ourselves up as the enemy, to not believe, because our role is to be a watchdog, our role is to seek the truth, our role is not to be, at least in my view and in my organization, is not the opposition party. There are publications that have set themselves up in that way, but I think that part of the issue of trust is your audience needs to understand that you want to seek the truth, good, bad, or indifferent. You need to understand the facts and present the facts to your audience and allow them to make their own judgments.
Let's talk about using the word lie. David Leonhardt in Sunday's New York Times listed all of what were called President Trump's lies. So I know everyone on this panel has an opinion about the use of that word. Jerry, I know that earlier this year you said you'd be careful about calling the president's statements lies because it implies, quote, it implies a deliberate intent to mislead. So do you think he's careless with the facts? Do you think he believes what he's saying? How do you explain it?
Well, so what I think is not really important, and you know, David Leonhardt can write articles. I think the president probably lies a lot, right? I mean, I think the president makes things up at times. I think I've got, you know, a fair amount of reason for believing that. The difference is not what I think or what I express as an opinion, what even I might be given reasonable grounds to believe. It's whether my reporters can report those things as fact. And if you're going to report something as fact, that something is a lie, you have to know that it's not only an untruth, it's not only a falsehood, you have to be able to impute motive. You have to be able to impute two things in the mind of the speaker: one, knowledge that it is actually untrue, and two, a deliberate intent to deceive. And I can see circumstances, perhaps, where I would have enough evidence that Donald Trump, or indeed anybody else for that matter, that they have enough evidence, they should have enough evidence to be able to know that it's truth, and that I would therefore be able somehow to infer from their deliberate falsehood that they were telling a lie. But it's a pretty high bar. And it doesn't just apply to lying. By the way, so our reporters, we're very careful about imputing motives to people without the evidence for the motive. And we are very strict about this. We don't impute jealousy or hatred or various other things. It is a judgment, making a call about whether or not someone's lying. Again, I don't rule it out completely. I said I'd be careful about it, and I think most people should be careful about it.
Jeff Goldberg is scowling.
No, I'm naturally scowly. No, that's just my default scowly face.
That's your resting scowl
no,
face?
No, my resting scowling face. Thank you, Katie. No, I I actually think it's okay to say that someone, when you present a president with a set of facts, about, let's say, the inauguration size, and you show them diagrams and you show them how many people fit within a grid, and you've shown him this over and over again. You've made that information available over and over again. And months later, he's telling you that he had the largest inauguration in history, or larger than Obama's. At a certain point, we have to treat him like an adult and say, this is a lie. He continues to lie about something that is provably untrue. I mean, it's not. And by the way, now, you know, by the way, all politicians lie. This is not a unique situation we're in. It's exaggerated. The other thing I was thinking about was something that Nancy just said, which is, I remember years ago, I interviewed Yasser Arafat twice within a 48-hour period. In the first interview, I asked him if he thought a two-state solution was possible, and he said, yes, absolutely. 48 hours later, I asked him the question again, and he said, it's not possible. I think he was telling the truth. I think both times he was telling the truth. And so there's this cognition issue that we have to deal with, which is, I think you're right. I think he believes the things that he's saying to be true in a genuine way. He's being honest with himself that he thinks the lies are true. You know what I mean?
And the reason I think that's so important is because, you know, I mean, anyone can sort of police statements, and fact-checking will always be a fundamental part of any news organization. But at a higher level, what a president believes through our history has led this country into war and taken us out of them. It has led a president to commit to putting a man on the moon. It is enormously consequential what a president believes. And so it seems to me if we ignore that piece to only focus on the empirically provable truth or falsehood of a statement, we risk missing an important ingredient in understanding where we're likely to be going as a country. And
can I just say, it's also something, it's all very well for you to talk about the president, but it is something then that we as news organizations would have to routinely apply to statements that are said. Chief executives lie, they mislead, they misrepresent. All politicians that we've just said lie, mislead. You know, God help us, members of the media sometimes actually lie. Are we going to be in a position where we are going to have to test every single statement that's put to us, not on the grounds of truth and falsehood, which is what we should do and what we do, but actually in an attempt to understand the intent and the motivation of the speaker? I think it's an extraordinary burden to place on us. And in the end, by the way, I don't think it really actually matters hugely, because if you demonstrate, as we do, President Trump says something, these are the facts, we can demonstrate that these are the facts, we can demonstrate that he had probable reason to know the facts, what do we actually further gain for a skeptical reader? A reader who still at that point isn't prepared to give it the appellation a lie, what do we actually gain by saying, you know what, so actually it's a lie, and now you'll be convinced that it's a lie? It's people want to apply this to this president. He does speak a lot of untruths, I've absolutely no doubt about that. But if you think about the consequences of that, we would be required to make that moral judgment, that judgment about whether or not someone was deliberately misleading in every single story we did. And I do, and I just think that's an impossible burden.
But you do think people should be called out when it's clear. Like
absolutely.
When LBJ was lying about Vietnam for years, and many lives were lost as a result. Media had called
him out
sooner.
New York Times didn't do front page stories saying he lied. They did front page stories saying this is what he said, these are the facts, probable reason to believe that he should have known the facts. We've now decided that we just routinely will call what somebody says a lie. I just think it's a very high standard that you have to apply to everybody.
Let's move on and talk about sort of the bifurcated nature of the media these days. You know, it's consumers are increasingly gravitating toward outlets that basically tell them what they want to hear, reinforce their beliefs. A friend of mine said they're seeking affirmation, not information. So given that, how do you restore trust in the media writ large if people are so divided about which media outlets are actually fair and accurate? Anybody? Nick, you want to take that?
Sure. And I would say that I think Jerry made a very eloquent argument on the previous point, and it leads to what you're asking about, which is, I think there is a tendency, we should not fall into the trap of just holding one person to one standard and everyone else to a different standard. I do think, it's interesting, three of us have all worked at the Wall Street Journal, or work at the Wall Street Journal, and...
I did before I left the office.
Yes, exactly. And our former Jerry's predecessor, a couple of predecessors, Paul Steiger, used to always remind us, saying, look, I could argue something round or I could argue it flat, but in the end, stick to the facts. And I think sometimes there is too much of a tendency to interpret a fact to a degree that it goes into opinion. And I think part of our job is to, again, remind ourselves that our readers are not as readers, viewers, users, are not as ignorant or stupid as we think they are. And I think part of that is to be more transparent. Part of that is to be more forthcoming about what we know and what we don't know. The first rule we all learned is don't just tell your readers what you know, please tell them what you do not know.
Well, I think that's important. But getting back to sort of like, you know, hearing the news you want to hear, is it going to be ever thus? I mean, is objectivity, true objectivity, in some cases simply not as desirable as it once was? People want journalists or you know, analysts, whatever, to have an opinion and to pick a side.
I think that there is a couple of things.
Certainly on television, increasingly in cable, right?
Well, I think there's again, it's not all monolithic. There are media is a business. If people are going to flock to a certain thing, you're not going to stop them from doing it, right? I mean, so that's a certain piece of it. But I do think, Jeff raised this, quality does count. And quality does attract subscribers, and it does attract advertisers. And in the end, you do believe that quality wins out. And you know, I think you have to hold to that belief.
Can I also point out, though, that there's a lot of obsession here and in the media with what's going on at a minute level in the White House. In real life, people have other concerns. And so there is a venue to bring people together. There is common ground for people in other ways. So, you know, of our 110 publications, half are in red states, half are in blue states. So we're hearing from and talking to and giving a platform to people from many, many different viewpoints. And so they have many, many different interests. So there is I think we're in a moment in time. I also think that these things are cyclical. I mean, if you go back 100 years ago when there was yellow journalism, and, you know, you can look at the newspaper wars that were very similar to the ratings wars and the click wars that we have now. It led to lots of irresponsibility and lots of lying and lots of, you know, nonsense, and ultimately burned itself out. There's a cycle to these things.
And you know what's interesting? I read a piece not long ago that a lot of people, I think the media itself, gets so obsessed with sort of cable news. And so many people don't watch cable news, right? Which I think if you're in the business, you find shocking, because so many people we know are watching it. And yet, sorry, Nick, a lot of people don't get their news and information that way. They get it from local papers. They get it from USA Today. They get it from their local news stations as well. So it's not as influential. And maybe that's one of the reasons, Jeff, that President Trump's base is really sticking with him in some ways. They're not being influenced, or are they being reinforced by, say, Fox News?
I suppose so. I don't know how they're getting information much better than you know how they're getting information. I would say social media, obviously, is the X factor here. I mean, people are, you have the ability now to curate your news feed in a way that you never had before. And I think people can seal themselves hermetically away from things that upset them in a kind of way. And so I think that's social media is democratizing, and that's great, but it has allowed anyone. I mean, you could be an 18-year-old in Estonia writing fake news that works its way into the system, and you can't expunge it from the system. And so our defenses are being overwhelmed in a kind of way.
Let's talk about social media, and sort of obviously there's a lot of pressure to feed the beast, right? To not only file your story like you did in the good old days and wait for it, but to constantly tweet, retweet, analyze, put little pieces of information out in social media. Do any of you worry that reporters that were, you know, normally straight reporters, kind of down the middle reporters, are being much more opinionated on social media? And do you have to keep an eye out for that?
Well, we have a policy about not voicing opinions, not voicing political opinions.
in any of your social sites.
But certainly you've noticed, Joanne, that a lot of people do. And Jerry, do you have a policy? And do you ever say, hey, easy trigger, stop doing that?
Yeah, we do. I mean, one of the problems, I mean, we use social media to promote our stories, obviously, which is very beneficial to us. The problem comes when reporters and occasionally some editors decide to take to social media and get... The problem is, obviously, social media is so much of a kind of forum for the expression of opinion, and it's very easy for reporters who are there supposed to be dealing with the facts and not with opinion to get caught up in that. And we have occasional problems where reporters will be out there expressing opinion about a story. They'll post their own story, or they'll refer to another story and they'll offer an observation about it.
It'll be a whole echo chamber of discussion among reporters.
But they have to understand how much that undermines the reader's trust. It's all about the reader or the viewer for me. And if a reader or viewer sees a story by a reporter which purports to be objective, purports to be an account of the facts, and then sees that reporter on Twitter saying, by the way, Donald Trump's an idiot, he should never have been president of the United States, they're never going to trust anything that reporter writes again about Donald Trump. He or she will have completely undermined the trust that the reader has in them. So we really, this is the peril of not only social media, but of the way the media generally has gone for the last 50 years, that reporters are not content to report anymore. They want to be expressing opinion. They want to be shaping the news. And that's fine, but the cost of that is exactly what we're seeing today, which is the diminution of trust, the elimination of trust by so many people in reporters. And frankly, it's hard to blame them.
And Nick, I know that's something that has concerned you.
We talk about it all the time. I think whenever new reporters come in, I do a little training session, and I tell them two things. One is, when you're on social media, you're still broadcasting, you're still representing the brand, and it's very hard to do quality journalism in 140 characters. It's very hard to do a lot of things in 140 characters. And I'd say the second part is, in the quest for speed, just remember that speed can kill, and that you're all rushing to be first, as are we, as is everyone else. But an old editor once told me, it's way better to be late than be wrong. And I think that's a cardinal rule I think all journalists should live by. It's better to be late than be wrong. And I think social media encourages people to
speed over accuracy.
And that's a real flaw.
Jeff?
Well, I agree absolutely with what Jerry and Nick said. I have to do this with some humility because I'm a recovering Twitter addict. it's an incredibly enticing medium for wise asses, and most of us are wise asses, and we have quick reactions to things that are going on, and they're snarky and they're funny, or we think they're funny, and then we put it out there and we find that it's not funny, and so the temptations are overwhelming. But we don't have a policy, and maybe we should have a policy. My feeling is, if you have to tell people that you're always representing your news organization, no matter where you are on TV, on Twitter, or whatever, and you have to remind them to behave professionally, then maybe they shouldn't be with your news organization.
And Nancy, I was wondering, what would reporting look like today if, for example, Mitt Romney were president? Is objectivity possible when you're covering a president as unconventional as Donald Trump? And how do you separate his personality from his policies, his behavior, from his leadership? And what kind of challenges has that posed for your organization in general?
Well, I think one of the ways in which he was so unconventional is one of the things that made him fascinating and made him appeal to an unprecedented coalition of voters who elected him, was because you couldn't put him easily in an ideological box. That there were days where he sounded like he was to the left of Bernie Sanders, and there were days he sounded like he was to the right of Ted Cruz, and it was not... to the extent that people had an understanding of what policies they were voting for in voting for him, it didn't fit into any kind of a tidy package, and nothing that we have seen since then either. When he is the one who talks about wanting a healthcare bill with heart, he continues to defy any kind of ideological labeling, any kind of obvious kind of traditional, this is a mainstream establishment Republican, this is a social conservative Republican, or any of the taxonomies that we've used before. I actually think that is one of the reasons why he has been such an object of fascination and surprise, because you cannot predict where he is going to come down on a certain policy with any kind of certainty.
It's
Do you believe that people, that so much reporting on his tweets, so much reporting on his behavior, whether Melania held his hand, and all the things that seemed to be the focus of so much attention, and legitimately, I think, questions about Russia, but I think there was one study that said 55% of network news stories were now on Russia since Bob Mueller was appointed. But how much, how concerned are you that other important news stories and policy issues are being ignored? And Joanne, that's something you and I have talked about. I mean, that is something that Sarah Sanders said yesterday, which I thought, you know, rang true in terms of what the media is covering.
We see it every day. So yes, people want to jump on the latest Trump tweet, but there are so many other important issues that affect people every day. And this is one of the reasons why Trump was elected in the first place, is for people who felt like the issues they care about were being ignored. I mean, you know, for us, one of the major issues we see across the country in all of our properties is immigration. Because immigrants make up the core in so many different ways. I mean, in Iowa, where we have properties, immigrants are the majority of doctors in rural areas. In Kentucky, they're the majority of the horse trainers and the guys who work with the horse breeders. So, you know, in New York, where we have properties, they're in the agriculture. So this is an issue that works across the country. Everybody is interested in this. When we write about it, it pops. People care. And there are so many of these other issues that very often get squeezed out.
We're almost out of time. There's so much more I want to talk about. But let me go down the line, because Frank Luntz asked reporters this question. And I'm going to go down the line and ask you, of the 20 people you see every day, you interact with, your friends, your family, your coworkers, how many of them voted for Donald Trump? Jeff?
Zero.
Nancy?
Yeah, I think not many, and that's something I remind our newsroom of a lot, that the environment that they are operating in and living in is not a demographically accurate mirror of the country.
Nick?
Maybe the exception is a business network, but I wouldn't say half, but probably pretty close.
Pretty close to half?
If I count friends, family, my wife here and her family in Ohio, and I work at a business network, and, you know, fair number of people. So, you know, probably not half, but probably a little under that.
Joanne?
Actually, there's a few among our close friends and family, and I actually really try to spend some time talking with them and understanding and making sure. We had a very interesting Thanksgiving, I will tell you that. But it was civil, a lot of liquor, but very civil.
How many, though, out of 20?
I would say a minority, but there are a few.
Oh, wait, Jerry? Katie, I'm sorry, I forgot my Uncle Marty. I'm sorry.
Jerry?
Let me see. There was Ivanka, Jared. I think they both voted for Trump. Actually,
you hang out with them every day?
I'm like Nick, and I think this is an important point, and Frank's point is a very good one. Of course, most of the people in the media don't move in those circles. For a business newspaper, there was a lot of support for Donald Trump among CEOs. I'd say, and among a lot of the people that we know, I'd say less than half, but more than a quarter.
But Frank, I think
it gets to the, like, Jerry and I deal with business a lot, that the undercovered story, for example, in business, that few CEOs here, no one really talks about deregulation. No one talks about that effect on business, because, you know, it's interesting to business people. It's not necessarily interested to a wider world.
Yeah, I was at a dinner in Chicago last night with 12 CEOs. The topic of Russia and Mueller and the inquiry, literally in an hour and a half, didn't come up once. They talked about healthcare, deregulation, the economy, taxes, foreign policy more generally, this specific, and by the way, it wasn't like they were hostile or rather supportive of Trump. It just didn't come up. It just wasn't seen as an issue.
I think Frank's point of view is, how can you really cover Trump voters if when you're separated from them? Pauline Kael of The New Yorker, after Nixon's landslide in 1972, famously said she didn't know how that was possible because nobody she knew voted for Nixon. So I guess the question is, how can media outlets be more representative of the readers they're serving? Part of it is, you know, reminds me of that Atlantic article, shameless plug once again for the Atlantic, Jeff, but it was basically about how coastal cities have left the heartland behind. I think that was the title of that article. But, you know, we've read about The Guardian, who's kind of going to local reporters because so many local newspapers have folded, reaching out to reporters all across the country. How can we be less insulated and more reflective of the concerns of Americans everywhere?
Well, just a quick intervention. The important question for me as an editor now is not whether I'm meeting Trump voters in Washington, D.C. I have reporters out there every day who 100% of the people they're meeting with are Trump voters, and that's the metric that I would use to judge whether we're actually trying hard enough to listen.
Yeah, the important thing is the boots on the ground. I mean, like I said, we're half red and half blue, and also, if you look at, there was a census figure that something like 1 in 5 reporters, journalists, is based on in the coast, New York, D.C., or L.A. So we crunched the numbers, and we were something like 1 in 38. The vast majority of our reporters are on the ground in those areas, and you've got to be that. You can't be parachuting in. It doesn't work to parachute into these communities. You really have to be embedded and understand.
And this seems to be a bit of a self-correction, with all due respect. I mean, during the campaign, I think we weren't hearing those voices nearly as much.
We did. With the Wall Street Journal, we went out and we reported, and we did, I think, a better job, I would say it myself, of reporting on the conditions, the economic, political, social, cultural factors that led to Trump. But obviously what people need to do is to get out of New York and L.A. and Washington and come to places like Aspen, where they can really get in touch with Middle America.
Hashtag the heartland.
I think we have an absolutely representative audience here, and I'm such a pleasure to be.
We only have time for one more question, but tomorrow's the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, and these days, as we said, anyone can claim to be a journalist or reporter without any experience, without editors, without any standards. Fake news can come from the guy down the street or from some guy in Russia. So should there be something like the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval that can signal to readers or viewers that certain protocols are followed and standards are upheld, or is that just a crazy idea?
There's actually an answer to that in technology, and that's where I would really love to see Facebook and Google in particular stepping up. And I know that both companies are looking into this, because there are ways. You know, what we see is so determined by the algorithms that they create. And what's in your newsfeed is Facebook has figured that out with an algorithm that surfaces these things. There is and should be, and I know that there's some work being done around this, the ability for those to use technology to weed out false information and to push up in your search results or your newsfeed information that is legitimate.
Anybody else?
I'm a little nervous about the idea of 23-year-olds in Mountain View, California, deciding what's true or not.
I know they already do, but I
think the best. First of all, you're not going to herd a bunch of cats in media to sort of accept a one sort of seal of approval. I think the thing to do for the smart consumer is to go to tried and true outlets that over time have proven themselves to be trustworthy and become loyal to those outlets, and I think I believe that the truth will out. You can't live a life if you're in finance, if you're in tech, you can't be successful if you adhere to a fake set of facts. And I think that the truth at the end of the day will win.
But
I do.
Having said that, what about looking at news outlets that may have different ideological bents, so that you can kind of see. There may not be alternate facts, but there are different interpretations of any given set of facts, right?
So people should subscribe to the Weekly Standard, and they should subscribe to The Nation, and they should. I mean, you can't make the consumer more interested than the consumer wants to be, but you can encourage people to. And we are in a golden age, because people are reading more than ever, and people aren't more engaged. It is an inadvertent outcome of the previous election, the last election.
And that's going to have to be the last word, or they're going to kill me. So thank you all so much. Thank you.